Good morning, everyone. It's 9:15, and as I wrote to everyone, from now on, we will never start again 8:15, always 9:15. The one exception is that I will post the exam early in the morning. You may start whenever you wish, of course. Thank God. Yeah, that doesn't mean that I don't have a lot to say. And I'm going to start by saying that you will have gotten a mail telling you that there has been one student who tested positive. And fortunately, we've been through the situation and it's the faculty writing out and everybody's estimate is that, well, we've upheld all the distance and coverage and so on. And I can actually think of myself as being the most liable. So for that reason, we have decided that today will, well, and onwards will be fully online teaching only. Yes, alas, but that's the way of life these days. For that reason, I've made an extra Zoom link, which means that this link that we're on now, I will stay on that link for the remainder of the time, which means to lunch and onwards if need be. And this will be what I call the conceptual line. So when we move to exercises, if you have any conceptual problems, then please come to this line. There is also another Zoom link, which will be for the exercises. And I just need to make sure that I make someone host of that. So in the change, there might be a few stops and starts and so on. But hopefully it will get along well, and we will of course be online. Today we're a bit fewer TAs. There's one who's ill. Moving ahead, let's start with just a quick thing about using the chi-square between two histograms. So here we are. It's just a short comment, but I've experienced that people get surprised. You can do a chi-square between a function that you're fitting to a histogram, for example. But you can also do it between two histograms. And so repeating what the chi-square is, well, generally it's just the distance between here a function and the histogram values in units of the uncertainty. And you just keep that concept in mind. It should be in your mind already. Now, as we also discussed, there are two chi-square definitions. In fact, I've seen 5 different ones, but let's just stick with these two. Namely, observed minus expected, for histograms, divided by, and the uncertainty on the top is, well, the uncertainty squared is the expected number. Now, this is great because now at least you don't divide by zero. It's very few PDFs that go to zero. But now it's not clear how many, for example, for Gaussian, how many sigmas should you go out? 100, right? You could easily divide by tiny numbers here, but you would hopefully get zero here. But then number of degrees of freedom is not clear. The alternative is to divide by the observed here. And then it's very clear that empty bins are not included. This makes it more well-defined, but not necessarily good, especially if you have empty bins or low statistics. But of course, in that case, you move to the likelihood. Between two histograms, well, the chi-square is generally the difference divided by the error and the whole thing squared. The difference between two histograms is the observed in one histogram minus the observed in the other histogram for each bin. And the error is the square root of the count. So the error on the difference comes out to be very simple, just this. So here is a chi-square between two histograms. And this means that you can not only compare two histograms, but also you can fit with histograms. Imagine that you have some simulation or model which is not just a PDF. Well, at least not one you can write analytically. But you can produce histograms with your model. And now you vary one parameter and you make a series of histograms. And with those, you can calculate the chi-square for each of these. And again, you should get a parabola down, and at the bottom is the best fit. And what are the number of degrees of freedom in this case? Peter asks, very good question. Well, it's the number of bins where at least one of the histograms has some entries in it. So you only take the you only take the bins where at least one of them has an entry, so that you don't divide by zero. And what are the number of parameters in that case? Well, if you're changing just one parameter, and I would say making the making a series of templates with many in many dimensions is hard work, so that there would typically be just one fitting parameter. And that means it's the number of non-empty bins minus one in that case. So you can still have parameters. I hope that makes sense, Peter. All right, that was just a comment. Let's jump to today's subject, which is unfitting, more unfitting. And today I thought of not introducing much new conceptually, but simply taking a day of playing around with fitting. This also means that if you have coordinated being in your group for the project experiments, then this is also a good day to sort of review that data and make sure all is in place. And if you have problems with it, don't hesitate to stay on this line and see if, I'll gladly explain things as best as I can. But let's go to fitting. All right. Fitting and significance. And let's first start by just considering the case where you're fitting something which is a peak on a background. And this is an extremely common case throughout, well beyond physics. Because often you boil your data down to one final histogram and you're looking for features in this. And peaks are, I would say, the most common feature. Some value that keeps repeating itself. And because your detector or whatever, however you got the data, is not perfect, it's not a sharp peak, it's sort of a spread out peak. And then you get all sorts of other values following some background function, noise function, which can be very different, but this is what you're trying to fit. And maybe you don't know if there's a peak or not. And that is where the significance comes in. Just a few looks at it. Here's from spectroscopy, where clearly, it's some background which is conceptually strange, perhaps hard to fit, but there are clearly peaks around here. And here's an explanation for it, which I have a hard time following, except the ATPs. In medicine, it's also very used. Here are just a few examples, and notice how the background function here is complicated. And the peak happens to be right where the onset of the background is. Fortunately, the peak is big, so it's not that bad, but otherwise it could be. It's used in imaging a lot. It's used in music. So the concept is everywhere. And whenever you're fitting, you should, of course, make sure you have good starting values. Otherwise, it won't converge. But if you're searching for peaks, then how do you make sure that you're not just finding something that is a fluctuation of noise? And, does it help to fit other things simultaneously? And the example, which I might also take later as an exercise, can be seen here. So here's a fit, and it looks like the background is constant, and there's clearly one peak, and then there's, well, something that might be a peak. And now the question is, what is the significance of these peaks? Are you sure that there's a peak here, the first peak, and are you sure that there's a second peak here in the data? And from the fit, you can see that the chi-square comes out to be 115 with 92 degrees of freedom. That's a probability just above 5%. Well, it's not a super good fit, but it's acceptable. And, you know, by eye, it doesn't look too bad either. I also notice the fact that the typical count in a bin is roughly 10. And that means that the assumption or the approximation that the uncertainty is the square root of the number is reasonably good, but not perfect. So that might also play a slight role in getting a slightly lower number here. And then for the first peak, well, how do I judge the significance of this? Well, I look at the number of entries in that peak. So the estimate here is that there's 190 plus minus 18. And that is the, from that you get the significance. So 190 divided by 18, well, that's 10.6. 10.6 sigma. The probability of the noise here just jumping up to give that number of sigmas is, you know, you're completely certain that here's a peak. For the second case, well, it's not that certain because, well, you got 58 is the estimated count of events here. Notice I took the bin width into account. So this is actually how many extra events there seem to be above the background. The uncertainty, however, is 15. And so this is reasonably likely 3.7 sigma. The chance of this just jumping out of nowhere is reasonably low, right? 3 per mil and less. So there's maybe 1 in 2,000 chance. I'm estimating that it fits there. And then Kimi asks, I noticed that the probability of the chi-square depends a lot on the number of bins we choose when playing around with the fit. I know that you have said we should be thoughtful of how many bins we choose, but how to do that? Is there a good rule of thumb or something similar that I can choose the number of bins with? Well, good question. Thanks for that, Kimi. In the present case, my line of thinking would be, well, if I had data from 0 to 10, I would fit the whole thing. If the background does something weird towards the ends, then I might consider not including, well, stopping the fit before it does something weird, simply to keep the background PDF simple. But it's nice to have something called, well, this is called sideband. Parts of the fit where the fit is sensitive to the background only, so that it can fix the background or fit the background well in some parts of it. So in this case, I'll take the whole range into account. And then here are the two peaks, and naturally you want to include those. So for this, there's 100 bins and there are 8 parameters. There are 99 bins and 7 parameters. I haven't written the constant term out. And well, it gives a good chi-square. I would say this is a good fit. And notice, unlike many others who will do a fit, nobody goes through the chi-square calculation, if it's even a chi-square fit, and get a p-value out. So getting that far is good. And I think that's the best I can answer. But true. The more you fit, the more complicated it gets, and maybe the more parameters you need to involve. So keep it thoughtful. And I'll return to the binning in a moment. All right, so in general, parameters in a fit are justified if they're significant, you could say. if they're significantly away from their unit value. And a unit value here would be a peak of height zero, right? That's no peak. Or a correction that you multiply on, well, the if this is one or consistent with one, then it's not justified to have it in. You might have the simpler fit. You should always try for the simplest fit that describes all the main features. And in this case, if somebody was searching for a peak here, and let's say that they actually were, for experimental reasons, believed to have the same width, then the good experimenter would say, aha, this is a smart case where I can fit two peaks, but I might use the same width. And then the first peak is gonna have a much stronger impact on the width, which means that for the second peak, it's almost fixed. It means you have one parameter less. And I would say then the uncertainty on the count would go down. You would get a sharper fit and it would converge more easily because simply the number of parameters go down. So in this way, and maybe also answering Kimmy, if there's a calibration peak next to, then that is highly useful. And this is often what is used in smart experiments. Now, while let's just take another case, and here I take from an experiment I work on, the ATLAS experiment, where people have looked at, well, is there a new type of particle decaying to two so-called jets? Never mind what that is. And here we have a brutal log scale with number of events per bin. And well, you see how the scale was chosen to be logarithmic on the x-axis with equal width on a log scale of the binning. And this is the type of peaks you would be expecting if there was something there. And what they've done is to say, well, we look at the place with the largest peak, and then we calculate the p-value of that one. But if you have a big spectrum, well, something is going to fluctuate up, right? You see two out here where you expect little. Well, the uncertainty is also large. Careful of the end, because the uncertainty is very large. Here's the biggest sort of jump in it, as can be seen here. But they've also calculated the uncertainty here. And from that alone, you see that any jump up is within that uncertainty. So they get a p-value for a background only, and they get this value. So likely there's nothing else there. But in general, if you're fitting such a long spectrum, you're likely to get some fluctuations. And that means that you might, especially if the peaks are sharp, have hundreds of chances of having a peak, and then, well, maybe 1,000 chances, and then at least one is likely to be 3 sigma away. So how do you do that? Well, how do you deal with that? Well, when you fit for a peak, then first establish that you have a good background model. That's crucial. And then if you put in a peak, a potential peak in your PDF, then it has a floating amplitude, and just like we calculated before, it has a certain significance. This is considered what's a local significance, meaning just around these starting values, this is the significance you get. But you might be searching in many places, and so you should reduce your significance because, well, you're likely to see some jumping up and down the more you test. To get what's the global significance, meaning of the whole thing? Well, you ask yourself, and P again is the probability that you get. So you might get a very small probability. Let's say you get a 3 sigma peak when fitting. Then the probability of this just being noise is about 3 per mil. So P local would be 3 per mil. With a 3 sigma peak. But globally, you would say, but I had a lot of chances of getting such a small peak. And so this is the expression you should consider. Let's say you're fitting in 100 places and you get, you know, a 3 per mil peak, well, the approximation here is that, well, peak global is 30%, meaning it is reasonably likely that you just have background. You got a 3 sigma peak because we tested in many different places. And of course, you should plug it into this, but this is sort of the line of thinking. However, if you got the 10 sigma peak, or let's just say 5 sigma, then you have 1 in a million chance that your peak was jumping up. So if you're testing in 100 places, then 100 times 1 in a million, that's still 1 in 10,000. All right, that's unlikely. That is probably a real peak, even if you test it in many different places. All right, any questions regarding this? If not, then the last lecture of today, or the last set of slides today, is simply about plotting and fitting, because there's a slight art form to this, I would say. So, types of data and ways of fitting. And I say it's an art form because you have to think of what type of data it is. You might have discrete data. Well, continuous data, let's start with that. That's at least nice in the sense that you can plot a histogram. You shouldn't expect any jumping up and down. You can also have discrete data. This might be counting data. That's obviously discrete, but it might also be more subtle than that. All right, I see that there was a question on what was there before, so let me just answer that. Why is 1 per million much better than 3 per million? They are not the different, right? I'm missing something. Yes, if you were fitting a peak on a background, that was a 1 in a million chance that the background was just fluctuating up. Well, then it looks like a peak, right? That's around 5 sigma. So that's 1 in a million. I don't know where you got the 3 per million from. I was just assuming 1 in a million. But if you're fitting in 100 different places, then you would expect to get some peaks. So you should multiply your 1 in a million by 100. Well, then you get 1 in 10,000. That's still reasonably significant. So you probably have something there. But let's say you were fitting in 1 million places. I know that sounds extreme. It probably is. Well, then you would expect to get a roughly 5 sigma peak once in a while. And so in that case, your global significance would not be very great. I hope that explains it. Otherwise, ask me afterwards. Back to types of data. So discrete data can be obvious, but sometimes it's not very obvious. For example, the voltage readings that you did in the experiments, in the at least in the old set, I haven't tested the new setup or way of reading out, but the voltage you read out actually turns out maybe not to be continuous. It may be that it's 1 divided by 4096, because it comes from electronics and this is digitized. You don't get an infinite number of digits on it. So you can be cheated a lot by that. So always test if things are really continuous or discrete. And then there's other types of data, you know, text or images, but typically in the end, these are converted to one of the two above. So the looks continuous, but is discrete is one of the pitfalls, and you will see jumping up and down when plotting. If you have discrete data, you should make your histogram accordingly. And for example, if you have integer data, positive integers, like the binomial and Poisson data, then you should choose, let's say you have them between 0 and 10, then you should choose as a range from -0.5 to 10.5 with 11 bins. Because then the first bin is between -0.5 and 0.5. And then it's very, very clear where zero entries with value zero should go. They should, of course, go there. And the mid value of that bin is zero, which means when a fit comes, it doesn't use minus a half or a half as the center of the bin value and then moves everything by a half, which can make binomial and Poisson fits not go very well. So that's a very useful thing. And in general, you should think about, you know, what range do I want to plot in and what binning do I choose? And please choose a binning that you can also write in numbers on the left side of the plot. Now, and also don't hesitate in putting a lot of information in a plot, because people are going to use, if it's a good plot, then people are going to use it out of context. It's no longer in your thesis explaining two pages around it. No, people just see it and will draw their own conclusions if you don't give them the input needed. So here I found, a plot, and I just want you, each and every one, to take 20 seconds thinking, why is that plot not so great? All right, good suggestion of what is missing. Please just drop them in the chat right now. No axes. Well, I see an x-axis and a y-axis. There's no legend, no axis labels. True. It's a terrible plot, yeah, for all the reasons that you say. And there's no axis label, no legend, and there's no context. And those of you just going ahead on my slides, that's okay, but you're not learning that much from it. So here, at least I tried to do something about it, but it's still not good, because, well, there's a change in the binning width between the two histograms. And that means you're comparing this and you say, well, signal is 2/3 height of background. But that's just because you binned the background different, or the person who did this binned the background differently. Shame on them. And the amount of poor figures is near infinite out there. So when displaying data, you should consider several things. Do you want to make it as a type of histogram or bar chart? Is it best with a scatter plot? And I would say things in two dimensions are good. Using color here is a way of putting a third dimension in, and that's still good. Going beyond that, I think that's hard. Pie charts you can use for very simple things. And also putting an insert in is often a good thing if there's a small detail which you can't see on the main plot. When you produce plots, then you should ask yourself and I'll take all the questions afterwards. Let's just run through it. You should make sure that, well, plot often, because plots, your eyes are sharp at seeing small variations and differences and so on. So looking at a lot of numbers doesn't help you much, but looking at plots does. Now, some are just simple plots for checks. You don't think much about them and you don't put work into their style, but at least put the right axes in. And when you copy paste, which is great, then please change the axes if they really change. Now, the scale of to produce such cross-check plots are minutes. If you want to show plots to others, then you need to put work into them. If you want to convince others with plots, the message will be lost if you don't think about it. And so the time to produce such plots is, towards hours, maybe half an hour or so, but it takes time. You have to think about it. All the plots that eventually go into your theses should at least have 15 minutes or half an hour of thinking of how do I do this in an illustrative way. And then your thesis or project or work in the future will maybe or most likely boil down to between 1 and 5 sort of money plots. These are the things that show the result of all your work. And for those, don't hesitate in putting in up to days of work in them, because they're the thing that's going to convince people. They are not going to read 100 pages. That keeps, you know, it's only the very interested who will do that. But the plots are what will go around. And so making them great is important. Now, when plotting, just in general, always plot your data because, well, until you've seen it, things may be very different. And I recently had a case where a PhD student here in the group came and asked me and said, I'm doing 2 fits here and the likelihood fit gives good result, but the chi-square does not. My immediate thing was, have you seen these histograms? Have you plotted them? And he said, no, but they're so simple that, you know, it can't go wrong. And then I asked, well, just have a look. And here were the 2 histograms that he was comparing. And in the likelihood case, which does not include the uncertainties, this went well because you have some variations compared to almost no variations. But in the chi-square case, where it takes the uncertainties into account, things went to hell, not because the central values were wrong, but because the errors were very wrong. And it's one in many cases, including my own mistakes, where I didn't plot it. And only when I did I understand the grave mistake I was making. Plot things. And also here from Anscombe's quartet, you can see the difference you can get in what you see when you plot it, despite the fact that you get exactly the same output out in terms of a fit, right? If you fit these with the line, you get exactly the same thing, including chi-square and everything. But the difference, there's a large difference in the data. So let me try to take a walk through poor plots and illustrations. And one that I always thought was interesting was this one. It's how the it's a plot of the Black Plague or the Black Death. Now, looking at it, I would say the Greek and Turkish coast was hit hard, and so was Italy and southern Europe. And Denmark was, for example, not hit very hard. But the trouble here is that it's a plot showing the time when it arrived. And so that can mislead easily. Often the intensity of the colors used for intensity of the epidemic. Now, I think a better plot is this, and this is an animation, and I just want to know if you even see the animation now. I hope you do. So I would say that is a better illustration of what goes on. Of course, media, I would say journalists, no, you couldn't see it. Ah, okay. But it shows first a black dot here, then a bigger black dot. So it shows per year where the epidemic was. So that's a better way of showing the information from before. But of course, they had to go to an animation. Let's continue. I would say media and those doing the graphics for the media and I wouldn't say journalists in particular, but often things go wrong there. Here's one case. Here are many other cases. And typically what is done is that, they show things on a scale where 0 is very far down, right? This looks like the Democrats are way ahead of the Republicans and the Independents, but note it's 50% here. So it's not that great. people will also use, you know, the width of something to make you look at the area and not the height. I mean, who the hell did that plot? Here's a ranking, and it looks like, you know, this is a terrible place to do business in India. It turns out this is the top 10, so they're all pretty good. They don't show the bottom. Here is from our own little pond, namely Politiken, not so long ago, who tried to show, all right, here's the variation in number of deaths. And I looked at it and I was perplexed because what is this? Well, as it turns out, the y-axis is completely wrong. 15,000, 14,000, 13, 12, 11, 1,900. Somebody forgot something there. The x-axis is also extremely strange because when it said week, I thought, okay, maybe this is the weekly. No, it can't be. I mean, the numbers are huge. So it's, but it's not the yearly either. And worse yet, the lines here are not put with a year between them. And there's no legend for the blue curve, but this is the real data. And the models, that's just because those in the graphics department can't draw a model. So the best they have is a wavy line and they just put that on top. Well, I can't congratulate those who did the graphics for this. So let's instead look at some great plots and illustrations. And fortunately, there are many of these. Here's a famous early illustration, which shows Napoleon's march on Russia. And the width shows his the size of his army. And in brown is before the he reaches Moscow, and in black is afterwards. And just the visual lining shows very much that, well, it's not the Battle of Moscow that makes him lose a lot of troops, but going all the way to Moscow and back, well, man, the losses are significant. And I can say that there are two generals in Russia who never lost a war, and that is General January and General February. And this shows it very much. It's not the battle. Here's a display of Magellan's and Elcano's circumnavigation. And what I like about this is that even though it's, you know, a historic map, it has good legends, good extra information outside, and it has the insert where there's a lot of things going on and important dates. There you have it. An interesting thing is that despite all the horrors of this trip, or very few returned, when they returned, they kept the ship's log super accurate, nevertheless. And when they get back, it's one day off. And only slowly do they realize it's because they sailed around the world that they're one day off. And that's where the dateline actually comes from. Galileo watching Jupiter's moons. I mean, I also think this is a fantastic illustration, Jupiter and the moons. And it's such a simple illustration, you know, where are these moons? And just, you can see why he drew it that way, right? Here next to our own moon, Jupiter and its four moons. And from that, he was trying to figure out, you know, what period they had, but you could only see it ever so often. So, and he didn't know that it was relatively fast. Try to take a guess at what this is. Well, it's somebody who took all the logbooks of sailing and put them into a map. And in that way, you can see where traffic goes and also where continents are. And maybe in our time, you'll start getting these sailing routes in at least high summertime. Also, the Moore's Law, I think, is illustrated really well here. And then there are just nice illustrations, which are a little harder to read. Like these, where do academic fields sit, so to speak? And how is this map made? Well, it's made on the basis of who quotes who. So here there are from biochemistry to sociology, you know, a few quotes across. And from that, you can define what is a field of science. Colors again help. And colors and size are also used very much in this map, which shows the income per person and the life expectancy. It's of course a log scale down here, but it still shows pretty clearly, you know, the state of the world. And it has a good legend and so on. And if you haven't seen the TED talk by the famous statistician, then I recommend that. It's a Swedish guy who shows the state of the world exactly through plots like this. Using the background is also quite a smart thing to do. Here is a simple plot where this is the distance from the galaxy center. And well, a picture of a galaxy in the background gives you an idea of you know, how far out are we. The background is for example, also the population distribution in the world in latitude and longitude. Well, you would put a world map behind because people would be asking, you know, where does China and India fit into this? And yes, his name is Hans Rosling. And he's one of the few guys who's given several TED Talks. You can also use animations, but I suspect that this doesn't work very well. Let me see if I can even click this. Can you see that? Yes, all right, so that's the way we should have done it. I'm gonna keep it running. Now, this was a case where the people in the LHC said, well, if you're measuring timing, then to make a control that you're actually seeing timing correctly, you should see two peaks around plus minus 5 nanoseconds if you look carefully. So the first plot here is where we just take all data, also all the dirty stuff. And then slowly we put requirements on it and crank up the requirement also on the PDF, on the probability. And slowly we do see two peaks here and then the fits go in. And if you have such a case, I would recommend, you know, to include it. Such illustrations are usually very nice in showing, all right, what goes on as either more data or changing requirements change the data. You get to show the shape change. This has been done several times. Here's the Higgs discovery, where in red is what you would expect without a Higgs. And then slowly you try to see, well, there are places where things disagree, but more and more so here, it seems that a peak is slowly coming out here. Same, just collecting a lot of data. Well, I still don't see a peak down here, but as data increases, something happening here. And in the end, this turns out to be not just the most significant bump, but significant enough to make claims. Here's a nice illustration of where to put a coffee shop. Somebody actually did the analysis of where to put them in San Francisco area. I used to live close to this one. And by this, people might say, well, what's the density of the population? Should I put one here or not? So it's used in many places. Surely you will go out and to industry and be making plots like this. Here's one of a detector and how well it performs. And here you can see how each element of the detector actually performs here in real data and here in simulation. And well, you see a difference, and this then needs to be taken into account. There are tons of fun plots. In the end, they can also be super illustrative. Here is an almost Gaussian distribution. It's not Gaussian because it's skewed a little bit. But this is from the Polish test, whether people can, when they exit the high school, and you need to pass a score of 30. And I think it's very clear to see a human factor here, namely, nobody gets 30 or 29, hardly anyone, right? You would always say, ah, benefit of the doubt. And hence the very nice trend and thus very nice continuous scoring showing that probably there are no other effects, but around 30, you see the effect very clearly. Pie charts are rarely used very professionally, but I think this one of what the universe consists of is a good example of just showing also how little we know of what the universe really consists of. You may also do summary plots. And for those, again, you have to think and spend days in making it. Here is a summary plot of some of the searches done by the ATLAS experiment. And again, using color, context information, even the references, where to find them, and of course, how far out they extend here in mass range. I think it's a nice example. And again, color here from our competitor experiment in ATLAS called CMS, where different resonances show up and how they're collected is sort of illustrated in color. And so after seeing a lot of different plots, I hope that just inspired you to do some of these nice plots. What I think you will find is that you sit and you try and it takes forever and well, it's annoying and so on. But once you produce your first great plot, that macro or piece of code becomes the example that elevates all your later plots. So it's usually not until you write some sort of a report or thesis where you actually did a lot of work and you don't want to waste it on a poor plot that you look into all the, well, capabilities that Matplotlib or other places has and you start using it. And then once you've done it, all your later plots are usually much nicer because, well, I know how to do it. I have a template for it. So don't hesitate in making the template now. And don't hesitate in sharing them around. If you think you make a nice plot, I would love to have the code behind that. So yeah, and with that, I think we'll end today's lecture and go to today's exercises and a comment. As you may have seen in your mail, and now most or everybody, that we have had one that tested positive last night. So we've been writing around, the faculty have been writing out and so on. Seemingly, and going through the case, it's not likely that it has spread. And as I said, I was probably the most vulnerable in that. So for that reason, we do things online from now on. I put two links and I will stay on this link and have everybody who have questions about today's exercise, not conceptually, go on the other link and ask questions there. So all the TAs and I will be available there. And today's exercise is about fitting. So let me just quickly share. Whoops, that was nuts. Where is the... Oh, here we are. Yeah. Just had a lot of windows open. I assume you can see my browser, even if it doesn't have a green frame around it. So I switched a few things around. So first of all, there's a short exercise in calculating the weighted mean and the uncertainty on the weighted mean and the chi-square. And this is simply meant an exercise in preparation of your project. So if you feel any uncertainty in this, this is a short exercise just running through. And then there are two problems. There's one, which is a histogram of the company sizes in Denmark. And it looks smooth and continuous and an easy fit, but it's not that easy to fit. So I'd like you to try simply to play around with fitting functions. And also just start by asking yourself, it's a histogram. So what is the uncertainty? And do I have any bins which have low statistics in? Should I take that into account? And then maybe you can expand on the range later in the exercise. And another fitting exercise is called the coffee usage. This is from the coffee machine downstairs where we somewhat irregularly recorded how many cups of coffee were produced by the machine. And we did it throughout sort of October, November, and again, January, February, March. And with that, the question is, can you measure the length of the coffee of the Christmas vacation from that? And it's an example of, first of all, real data, and second of all, of a non-continuous fit, where you sort of have to fit and then flat and then fit again. So with that, let's stop the lecture here and start working on the exercises.